Please be seated.
Except for Justice Krofsky, she has a little back issue, and it helps to stand. So that means nothing other than she's standing today. Yeah, exactly. No, our ends are about even.
You have to stretch a little bit to get there.
All right. Today we have Wisconsin Lutheran High School with us. If you could please stand, we'd like to say hello to you. Good group. Nice to have you here today. Hopefully you enjoy the oral arguments, and afterward, Justice Dallet will be available to speak with you if you have an interest in the availability today. You can ask her anything you'd like, except for things about the cases that we're hearing today. Welcome. It's nice to see each and every one of you. Go ahead and have a seat. Colleen State versus Crystal Kaiser, 20 AP 192. Appearances, please. All right, good morning to both of you. Lineup is 25 minutes, 30 minutes, 5 minutes in rebuttal, right? Okay, please proceed.
Thank you and good morning. The issue before this court is the scope of the affirmative defense under Section 939-46-1M. Both parties agree that the circuit court here was incorrect to hold that the defense is limited to charged violations of the trafficking law. However, the state's position is that the statute also does not provide a blanket protection for all crimes a trafficking victim commits while being trafficked, nor is it simply sufficient that there is a close connection between the trafficking and the crime. The plain language of the statute limits the defense to crimes committed as a direct result of another person's violation of the trafficking laws. And based upon the common dictionary definitions of direct result and also how that term is defined in Wisconsin case law and statute, the state believes the defense is limited to crimes that a trafficking victim commits that are part and parcel of the trafficker's illegal actions. It is not a license for a victim to kill a trafficker. Additionally, when the defense does apply in cases of first-degree intentional homicide, it is textually subject to the mitigation provisions in sections 939.45.1 and 940.01.2.
Are we going to be talking at all today about the fact that she's alleged to have burned down his house?
Yes. I mean, she has asserted the trafficking defense for all of the crimes for which she's charged, which would include the homicide where she shot Mr. Volar twice in the head, the arson where she burnt down his building after doing the dishes, as well as the theft of the BMW that she did after the house was burning.
Okay. Thank you.
The state's position is that the trafficking defense statute has three elements. We have a victim who's committed a crime, that crime must be the direct result, and then that must be the direct result of the trafficker's violation of the trafficking law. And while the defense is not limited to formal acts of coercion as traditionally defined, the fact that the legislature placed the defense within the coercion statute and the history behind it, as well as the definition of direct result, means that this statute is intended to provide a trafficking victim with a defense for crimes that she is essentially forced to or commits under the influence of the trafficker. It's not a lessened form of self-defense and not an escape statute.
What history are you talking about?
Excuse me?
My mic on.
Yes.
Okay. What history are you talking about?
What history?
You're talking about the history of the human trafficking statute from 2008?
In terms of how the way the statute was inserted into the coercion statute. It's not a standalone provision. It was put in under the umbrella of coercion, which both informs the meaning of direct result and also informs whether it's a complete defense or whether it's subject to mitigation. We've provided, the state's provided, and the Court of Appeals provided several dictionary definitions and case law definitions of direct result.
Before you get to that, and of course that's a main part of our inquiry today, you gave in your preface a comment, the fact the legislature placed this within the coercion statute. Of what import is that?
Again, I think it's important to both the question of what direct result means, and then it's very important to the issue of whether it's subject to the mitigation provisions. So we have this general statute 93946, titled...
You cite to, I think, the Lopez case for the premise of the import of the title. And I note that that is a lead opinion. So...
I recognize that. I also note that this is not simply a standalone statutory title. Coercion is specifically referenced in both of the statutes that accomplish mitigation, in 93945(1) and 940012. The text specifically says coercion and then references 93946 generally. So that word, coercion, is part of the text of those other statutes.
Mr. Barber, if we're looking at the text of the statute, though, and I want to talk about the second part of your argument, which has to do with the mitigation. If I look at 939.46 sub 1, it is really clear that the last phrase of that statute, the last provision, talks specifically about a first-degree intentional homicide being reduced, mitigated, to a second degree. And we see that same language in other parts of the statute, right? We see it in necessity in 939.47, and there's one other place at least as well. That same language does not appear in 93946 sub 1M. So how do we draw any other conclusion by the fact that it doesn't appear in 1M other than, number one, the legislature knows how to write that language because it does in several other provisions of the statute, and it is completely absent.
And the state has recognized that it's not absent there. But the legislature also made a choice when it included that trafficking defense under the umbrella of coercion under 93946, so that when you're looking at the privilege statute, 93945, when the actor's conduct occurs under circumstances of coercion or necessity so as to be privileged under 93946. They did not state 93946(1). They did not state except 93946(1M). So it falls under that. So
then my question back to you is then, explain to me how sub 2 and sub 3 fit under that. If what you're telling me is that the language that you're getting from first-degree intentional homicide that mitigates it to second, and then you go through the privilege statute, right? And
yes.
Then you get to coercion, and 93945 takes you to coercion just using 93946. It does not give you a subsection. I'm doing exactly what I hate when other people do, which is say the statutes very, very quickly, so I'm going to try to stop doing that. But I'm trying to get you to that place.
Yep.
There are four subsections in 939.46. There's sub 1, sub 1M, sub 2, and sub 3. The way you're looking at that statute, by that statute I mean 93945, which brings you to 93946, you'd have to look at all four of those subsections, and I don't understand how sub 2 or sub 3 would possibly fit into your analysis. So you're asking me to look at sub 1, you're pulling in sub 2, and then am I supposed to ignore 2 and sub 2 and sub 3? I'm supposed to also include sub 1M, but then I feel like your analysis would force us to ignore sub 2 and sub 3.
Well, it's not ignoring it. It's just if you look at the substance of those, they simply don't apply in cases of homicide. You have sub 2 basically says, okay, we don't have a spousal coercion defense. That's the substance of that. So just by its substance, it doesn't apply. And then sub 3 is a specific type of coercion involving firearm straw purchases, where essentially if a person who took out a domestic abuse restraining order on another person purchased a firearm for that person, then there's a defense to that. So that's limited to that circumstance. It doesn't really ever get to first-degree intentional homicide.
So you're asking us to look at the statute, and if it's possible under the statute that first-degree intentional homicide could apply, then if it does apply, then we're supposed to know because we go to sub 1 or because we're coming through 93945 that it has to be. It feels a little tortured to me.
That's the way the statutes flow and the way they operate. And we assume that when the legislature passes a law, it knows what the existing law is. And it didn't change that reference under the privilege statute or under the statute that provides for medication.
Mr. Barber, don't we also assume that the legislature knows how to include language that when it does so in a specific subsection of a statute, yet chooses not to do so in another subsection, that we should take heed of that? And not only that, the language about the mitigation appears not just in 939.46, but in, I believe, three other places, closely related statutes, yet it doesn't appear in sub 1M.
And again, we have recognized that, but we have the absence of that language there, but we also have these other statutes, the privilege statutes, that pull it in. We referenced the Lopez case in our brief, and while that involved a different statutory scheme, I just want to look at the court's logic or rationale here. Paragraph 22 from Lopez. Lopez argues because the retail theft statute does not have its own specific aggregation statute, the legislature did not intend it to be aggregated. We disagree. The fact that other statutes exist with aggregation does not demonstrate the legislature concluded this statute excluded aggregation. And that's really what we're talking about here. Yes, there are other statutes that have this specific mitigation language. But the fact that the privilege and mitigation statutes were not amended to exclude this defense, that same logic applies here. And then, even with that, then we have, what's the result of this? And the state simply thinks it's an absurd result to say that if we take a hypothetical that changes the facts a bit here, that we have, instead of someone paying a minor to come down and in the past perform sex acts, because there's no allegation on this specific date. But let's say we have an individual who is simply grooming a child, who is repeatedly sexually abusing a minor, and the same thing happens. Because, under their interpretation, because in their case there is an exchange of money in the past, it's a complete defense, but in the other case it's not. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to the state.
It may not, but isn't that a policy choice that the legislature made?
I don't think I've seen nothing in the legislative history, and certainly the defense has not pointed to anything that demonstrates that there was any indication or any thought that this would apply in cases of first-degree intentional homicide.
I don't want to say I don't care what the legislative history says, but I don't care because we have a text that we need to interpret, right?
I understand that, but, as part of the statutory analysis, we do look at whether the result would be an absurd result. So that's just another...
the legislature is perfect. It's their prerogative to enact into law statutes that might have absurd results. That's a different application of the canon, I think. And I
understand there's differences of opinion as to the import of that among the justices. That is, I don't think I'm going to convince anyone to change their views on that. But that ties back, though, into this definition of direct result.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I have a question for you on that. So why isn't it a jury why isn't it a question for the jury, a fact for the jury to determine whether or not Ms. Kaiser killed her sex trafficker, for what reason? So the state, for example, at trial could say she killed him for financial reasons. She wanted his BMW, so she saw an opportunity that she's going to kill him and take the BMW. She, on the other hand, could say, I'm trying to escape from an inescapable situation. I'm being trafficked. I had no way out. I was desperate. I was being abused, and this was the only way out for me. Why isn't that an issue, a fact, for the jury to determine?
So I have two points to answer that question. The first is, ultimately, it is a factual matter once we define what direct result means. And we have to also look at the text of the statute saying a direct result of the trafficker's illegal actions. And the state's position is that this is not a escape or revenge statute. This applies to crimes a crime victim commits that are related to the trafficker's trafficking.
But it doesn't say that. It says as a direct result of the violation of the trafficking statute.
Right, and direct result means it has to be something that's proximate, immediate, flowing immediately without any intervening factors. If you look at the jury instruction for cause, 901, on page 3, there's a comment here that says, you know, essentially, there's some older statutes that use the phrase as a result, which means cause, substantial factor. But here, as the Court of Appeals noted, the legislature inserted the word direct, intending to tighten that up. So this is more than a substantial factor. And the state's position is that if Ms. Kaiser is arguing that she did this because she didn't want to be trafficked anymore, that she shot him because she was tired, as she alleges, of him touching her leg in this instance.
I think it was more than her leg, but go on.
Well, in this, there's an allegation of that in the past, but
Mr. Barber, I'm sorry. But he did so much. Come on. You can make this argument, but we all owe it. The Constitution says that we need to treat victims with dignity and respect. Part of that is acknowledging what actually happened to them. And Ms. Kaiser, undeniably here, was a victim of human trafficking. And so I understand the point you're trying to make, but I think to say that she did this because he was touching her leg is just so far from what actually was going on.
That's what they have alleged for the date in question. And I fully acknowledged there are a lot of allegations about horrendous things Mr. Volar did.
The problem with your argument is this, and I need you to respond to this, because this is the biggest hang-up I have with your argument, is that the way you are looking at that is the way I view your argument is that you are looking at human trafficking as some sort of crime that is, it happens one time. It is a one-time going into a convenience store robbery, and then it is over. This crime here that we are talking about, these crimes here, it is a multitude of crime that had happened over a period of years. And so if it were one incident over, a number of minutes, it would be one thing. But this has happened over a long, long period of time. So I think what the other side is saying is it's a direct result out of this years of abuse that she is trying to get. And so I don't understand how your argument, I just don't understand how your argument, if you're looking at human trafficking as something that happens over a long period of time, your argument doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I disagree in that what doesn't make sense to me is the notion that if their interpretation of this is as broad as they say, then that completely eliminates any need to rely on the traditional statutes of self-defense, provocation, or coercion, which have very tight restrictions for reasonableness and necessity, and that they're essentially asking the court to construe this statute as somehow replacing that and saying, if you're a trafficking victim, the fact you are trafficked is enough to justify taking someone's life. And I'm not at all downplaying what Mr. Volar did. I completely agree. It's horrendous. This stuff does happen over a number of years. And that's why when we're talking about what does this apply to, again, the state looks at it as circumstances where, because of this long timeline of trafficking and abuse, the victim feels compelled to do what the trafficker wants. If she is an imminent danger or threat of great bodily harm, there's a statute for that.
Where do you get compelled to do what the trafficker wants? I'm reading this, and it says has an affirmative defense for any offense. The legislature chose the words
and chose to say any offense committed as a direct result. They could have limited it. They could have, right? So where I feel like you're inserting language and also discounting what could be a substitution that the legislature has sought in these specific circumstances where the victim is a victim of human trafficking.
It's the definition of direct result of the trafficker's actions. As we state in our brief, there are other states that have similar trafficking laws, but they're broader. They say any offense as a result of being a victim, any offense that occurs while being trafficked. The legislature put this phrase in, which doesn't appear anywhere else in the criminal law. This is a distinct, and the state believes it was intended to apply to this narrow set of circumstances where the victim is doing something as a direct result of what the trafficker has done.
But aren't you reading direct results a little too strictly? I mean, here we have a 15-year-old girl who went to the police. She said she was being sexually abused and trafficked. The police went to his house. And tell me if you disagree with anything, because I'm kind of reading from your friend on the other side's brief. They found evidence that this 34-year-old man was paying girls for sex, using them to make child pornography, prostituting them out to other men. His bank called the police. They had frozen his account on suspicion of being involved with human trafficking. The police arrested him and collected his DNA. And then he was released without bond. So we have a 15-year-old girl who goes to the police. They arrest him, and he walks without any bond. And, again, I go back to my earlier question. Why isn't this a question for the jury? We're not being asked here today to determine whether or not Crystal Kaiser is going to be convicted of this offense or whether or not the affirmative defense will be successful. That's a question for the jury. So how can this court, I feel like we're being asked to make a factual determination here. The state is free to present its case and say, look, she didn't do this because she was being trafficked. She did this for some other reason, for financial opportunity, for financial gain. But why isn't Ms. Kaiser entitled to present her defense that she did this because she was being trafficked?
Ultimately, yes, like I said before, it's a jury question, but just like we do with self-defense, just like we do with coercion, there is this limited gatekeeping function under the sum evidence standard of what does she need to present evidence of to get this question to the jury. And the state does not believe this statute covers someone who intentionally travels from one city to the other and is texting saying, I'm waiting for the pizza to come to arrive and his head's going to splatter everywhere. That cannot be what the legislature intended this defense to apply to.
Well, that's a factual determination, right? Because your facts differ from the defense facts on all.
I would like to interrupt a little bit to ask a question. I am concerned about the different crimes that have been charged, and I am wondering, do they have different temporal components? To me, the word direct has got a temporal component, so that's the foundation of my question to you. Is there a different temporal component that would cause it to be a direct result when you look at burning down the house? Is there a different temporal component that would cause it to be direct when you're talking about her shooting him in the head when he was trying to hold on to her or whatever he was trying to do at that moment? Is there a different temporal component if he hadn't touched her at all and she just decided today is the day you're leaving and walked in and shot him in the head? To be direct, each one of those different crimes that she's alleged to have committed may sit differently under the statute's terminology. So that's what I'd like you to help me with a little bit.
And that's been a concern of the states, because at the circuit court, they essentially argued, Ms. Kaiser argued, that this is just but for, that she was down there because she was being trafficked, therefore everything she did, burning his house, stealing the car, that's all, in their view, related, has a close connection, as they say. And the state just disagrees with that. That's part of the state's concern here is frustration. Your point about the temporal component is, At what point do we have it where how much time has to pass between the last act of trafficking and killing someone where it's severed?
You know, there's another question you can ask. Does any amount of time that's specified have to pass? Because if it was just the fear of being trafficked in the future, you know, is that sufficient? I mean, this statute is a real conundrum for me.
Well, and because of that, that's why we are looking at these definitions that include these concepts of proximate cause, of immediacy, that there's no intervening factors or motivations.
But the problem with your theory, I'm sorry.
Never mind. That's fine. Go ahead.
The problem with the theory, and to Justice Kurofsky's point, it seems the state is looking at trafficking as sort of a one-off offense, but trafficking is an offense that for the entire amount of time, which for many people is years, it doesn't stop. It consumes their entire life. It directs their entire life because they are under the coercion of another person. They're under the control of another person who has manipulated them into doing almost everything that they do in life during that time. So it's not a one-off crime like, you know, well.
Yeah, and the state understands that, but I guess at the end of the day, if this statute is broad enough, as they say, and taking everything you said into account, this really seems like if you're being trafficked, you can kill your trafficker and not face any liability.
Well, that's not true, because she's going to trial. The jury can reject the defense if this court allows her to present it. So it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. She still has to convince a jury that she did this because she was being trafficked and not for financial gain or some other reason.
Well, I mean, she has to show the jury that she was a trafficking victim who committed a crime that was a direct result of his actions. And may I finish my answer here? Okay. And the state does not believe that killing someone to get out of a trafficking situation is what is contemplated under the statute. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Yart.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Katie York, and I represent Crystal Kaiser. I had a whole intro prepared, but I think I'm going to jump right into the issues that opposing counsel has raised because I feel like we're right in it. First of all, the legislature chose any offense. This affirmative defense applies to any offense, and that's because that is the language that the legislature chose. They certainly could have limited it to certain types of crimes, but they did not do so. So we are looking at what the legislature chose in enacting the plain language of the statute. I would like to remind the court that this case is pretrial, right? So we don't have a lot of evidence in the record, which makes it a bit difficult when we're analyzing what direct result means, because we're not looking at facts yet. We have kind of the tip of the iceberg, some of the evidence that potentially will be presented at trial, but we don't have the entire picture yet. But I think the Court of Appeals did a really good job of coming up with some guidance for the circuit court. And I do think direct result is always going to be a fact-intensive inquiry based on the facts and circumstances presented by both the state and the defense in any given case.
Ms. York, go ahead.
Thank you. Let's look at what the Court of Appeals did, since you said they did a good job.
Sure.
Paragraph 15 is where they addressed the definition, the summary of the definition of direct result. And in the paragraphs prior to that, they distilled, for instance, in paragraphs 14, 13, 12, 11. They talked about any, of course, which is an important word here, and then got into what does it mean to be direct result in paragraph, I think it is 10. And after going through the definition found in dictionaries and, importantly, definitions in
case law to inform its decision. It landed on paragraph 15, which said this, in a non-inclusive way, direct result means relatively immediately from the traffic violation, number one. Number two, it's motivated primarily by the traffic violation. And number three, it's not in significant part caused by circumstances or considerations other than the violation. Are you in accord with that summary of what direct result means? And can you add anything further to the discussion other than those three areas which were distilled by the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what I have quoted in my notes, and we would be in agreement with that analysis by the Court of Appeals. Like you said, they went through several dictionary definitions and case law interpreting both direct and result in different circumstances. I think that's a reasonable summation and would provide some guidance to the circuit court when determining whether there is some evidence to determine whether or not this jury instruction should go to the jury. Other factors that could be taken into consideration would include the trafficking victim's age and mental capacity, whether violence or force was involved, whether threats of deportation or arrest were utilized, whether the victim was isolated and made to be dependent on the trafficker, whether the victim was the subject of psychological abuse. And, of course, there's a wide variety of circumstances, facts, that could be relevant in any given case. Trafficking is a pretty complex evil, and it affects different people in different ways. But, yes, there are a number of factors that could be taken into consideration. But, really, I think the point we want to make is that it depends on the facts and circumstances of any given case, and in this case, we're not there yet. I feel like Justice Hagedorn's ready.
The procedural posture makes this an unusual, you know, case for us to deal with. And maybe you've just answered, you know, the question, and I have this for your opposing counsel as well, but we need to write an opinion. What exactly do you think we should say here? Is your position just duplicate what the Court of Appeals said and with the caveats that you just added on there? Any other limitations, any other holdings? What exactly would you like us to say?
Sure. I would not have any problem with you parroting what the Court of Appeals said as far as their summation about what direct result means. I think, of course, making the point that it is a fact-intensive inquiry that is going to depend on the facts and circumstances of any given case is important. And when we're talking about the affirmative defense for trafficking victims, although it's been in existence since 2008, there aren't any cases interpreting it, right? So we're not just talking about Crystal's case. She's not the only trafficking victim out there that is being charged with crimes. We're talking about all trafficking victims in a wide variety of circumstances. We're talking about any offense. So, yes, we're talking about homicide, in this case, the most severe offense on the books, but that's not everything. And so I think there needs to be some flexibility, and we have to, or the court should stay true to the language of the statute, which is direct result. And quite frankly, if the jury was given the phrase direct result, I think the jury can apply the facts and circumstances to the statutory language. And we ask juries to make decisions on what is reasonable, what's not reasonable, and in cases all the time. What does that mean? Well, it depends on the facts and circumstances of any given case.
The interesting thing I'm thinking about here is normally with any kind of defenses that might be offered, as long as there's some evidence, you know, the trial court, you know, is supposed to give that instruction, obviously, if it's been, you know, asked for, make those things. And so I'm trying to figure out, if you define something as, you know, a multi-factor kind of, you know, it could mean all kinds of things, how are lower courts supposed to apply this practically? And I'm wondering if you see any complications, any boundaries, any other guidance that might be helpful here. Do you get what I'm saying? I mean, if anything can be a direct result, you know, and it's just a list of factors that could be relevant to such a thing?
Yeah.
That seems awfully hard to apply.
Well, I think what the Court of Appeals did, I mean, they didn't just list factors like I just listed. They're talking about a temporal component. They're talking about relatively immediately, motivated primarily, logical and reasonably foreseeable consequence. So with that clarification, they're pulling in an inherent nature of reasonableness, and they're pulling in an inherent nature of kind of pulling it in so it's not a more extreme circumstance, I guess. And they're pulling in concepts of intervening circumstances and things like that and saying that you look at all of the facts and circumstances to determine whether it's a direct result. But I don't think there's a way to create a bright line rule of, like, here are your guardrails in every single case. I just don't think that's possible given the language of the statute and given the fact that each case is going to differ on the facts and circumstances.
Do you think any kind of, you know, coercion element, you know, should make its way into this, or do you reject that altogether?
I reject that. A coercion is the title. It's not part of the statute. And the title can't be used to change the language of the statute. And the language is direct result. And direct result does not inherently include an element of coercion. Now, is it true that in trafficking there oftentimes are coercive components? Absolutely. Is that something that could be presented at trial, that was something that was going on here? Sure, but that's not an element of the affirmative defense here.
Is it required at all when it comes to juveniles who are trafficked?
It does not. If you're trying to prove child sex trafficking, there is no element of coercion that's required. There's no requirement for a threat or force or anything like that.
So is this just a totally misplaced statute in your view? I mean, the odd thing about it is, I mean, you do have these other textual links that describe this section as a coercion statute beyond the title, and we've, you know, used that to interpret context. The legislature put it there when it was writing this. Surely that has to have some relevance to the way we think about the statute. I mean, it almost seems like your argument is this was just a big whoopsie by the legislature because it doesn't really have anything to do with coercion. And is that being fair to the statutory context?
No, I don't think it's a whoopsie. given
another question?
given
a technical term.
You know, given the arguments that we're making here, is it cleaner for me if it was its standalone provision? Sure. But that's a bit of Monday morning quarterbacking on my part. I think it makes sense to go in the coercion statute because there are inherent coercive qualities to trafficking, and this is a trafficking defense. Or an affirmative defense for trafficking victims. So, you know, similarly to sub 3, which is the straw arm purchasing, and I don't want to get into the details of those sections, but it's kind of a similar idea. There's coercion inherent in that affirmative defense, but it doesn't pull in an element of coercion. It doesn't pull in the threat or force that we're seeing in sub 1. And the coercion defense is something that existed at common law. And when we're talking about when coercion was enacted under 939.46 back in 1955, coercion meant sub 1. And when we look at sub 2, which was the only other subsection in existence at that time, they're talking about what is not coercion and what is not a presumption of coercion. And they use the term coercion, no presumption of coercion. And what they're talking about is sub 1. Same goes for the privilege statute, which talks about under circumstances of coercion back in 1955 when 939.45 and 939.46 were enacted, coercion was the coercion defense, which was at common law and codified in 939.46 sub 1. Okay. So just one more note on direct result. The state is proposing a definition that direct result means in furtherance of or part and parcel of the trafficking conduct or the trafficking enterprise. That simply is not the language of the statute. Certainly, there could be circumstances where a trafficker directs a trafficking victim to do something and they could use this affirmative defense, but that doesn't cover everything that could be considered to be a direct result.
Counsel, do the different crimes with which your client has been charged have different temporal components when the jury looks at direct effect?
Yeah, I think the jury is going to have to look at direct result as it relates specifically to each offense charged, and certainly we'll look at the temporal component as it relates to every charge. So, it, you know, conceivably, the jury could come up with different conclusions on whether or not certain offenses that are charged were a direct result. But that's going to be, a fact-intensive inquiry based on the circumstances presented at trial. So beyond the direct result language, this court is asked to determine whether or not the affirmative defense here provides a complete defense for first-degree intentional homicide or simply mitigates to second degree. First of all, in sub 1M, there is no mitigating language. The statute itself does not limit or mitigate first-degree intentional homicide to second-degree intentional homicide. This is significant based on the plain language, but also when we're looking at similar statutes. For example, coercion and necessity, sub 1, which is right above 1M and 939.47, both statutes specifically mitigate first degree to second degree if there's a sexual
assault. Aren't you arguing that the statute is stronger than the self-defense statute, which up until this was passed was certainly the one statute where one could kill another person intentionally and walk away?
I don't know that I'm arguing that it's stronger. I'm arguing that it is that the legislature enacted, and like perfect self-defense, right, there is no mitigation language within the statute.
But every time there's a claim of self-defense, that the, beyond a reasonable doubt, is not warranted. There is always the concern about imperfect self-defense, mm-hmm, which then just mitigates it to second-degree homicide, right? Mm-hmm. So what you're arguing is that this statute is stronger than the self-defense statute. And, you know, as I read this and thought about the circumstances that are in your brief and in the record elsewhere, you could argue that what she did was self-defense, okay? But if it's self-defense, then you can also have imperfect self-defense. Did she really have to shoot him in the head to get out of the trafficking situation? So what you're arguing is that this statute can't be mitigated, and when it can't be mitigated, it's really stronger than the self-defense statute.
Well, I would push back a little bit on that because perfect self-defense and imperfect self-defense have different elements, right?
Oh,
if someone proves perfect self-defense, they're acting reasonably.
I agree they have different elements. I'm just talking about the effect on what is not prosecuted as a crime. And what you're telling us, if we buy your argument, is that this is stronger than self-defense because it doesn't matter whether she did it at the moment that she was trying to be trafficked or whether she did it as a result of months or years of trafficking and the effect that had onto her. You're saying there's no mitigation, and that's the state's second argument, and what you're telling me is that it's really stronger than self-defense because she doesn't have to prove there was no other way around the bush when she shot him in the head. Uh-huh. That was it. And she had absolutely a privilege to do it under the statutes.
I don't know that I agree that I would classify one as stronger or less strong than the other. But I think the concern that you're raising really has to do with direct result and how tight that definition is. Yeah. And I think probably part of the inherent issue that you're seeing is that self-defense pulls in this reasonableness of your conduct. But I think when we look at paragraph 15 of what the Court of Appeals did, they did pull in reasonableness, right? And they did pull in the temporal component, that it has to be relatively immediate, motivated primarily.
I don't think they lined it up with the different acts that are alleged to have been criminal acts here. You know, what is a direct result of burning down someone's house may be different than what is a direct result of shooting someone who's trying to attack you.
Mm-hmm.
So I am troubled by the different charges here, and I have a hard time. I'm not very good on hypotheticals, but this case is really bad for me.
Yeah, well, no, and you know what? That's fair, and part of that is the procedural posture that we're in, right? Because we don't have the evidence that was presented at
trial.
And we don't have any other cases interpreting the statute. So it does, yes, it absolutely, you know, makes you think of all the scenarios, but really we have to look at the language of the statute and we have to look at the facts and circumstances that are presented in any given case. And for those circumstances where, you know, you're envisioning maybe that this shouldn't be a direct result, the state has the opportunity to present its case and explain why it's not a direct result in that circumstance. And quite frankly, we trust jury to make these fact determinations all the time based on the language that the legislature
right, but
enacted.
We tell them what the words mean. And that's what we're supposed to do here, which is the problem.
Yes, and yes, absolutely. And I think they can use their common sense when they're looking at the language direct result. But I also think that what the Court of Appeals did in paragraph 15 does provide some guidance for the court and potentially for the jury if the jury was instructed that way.
I have a question for you about the mitigation issue. Are you done, Justice Roginson?
Yes.
Thank you. So your best argument is obviously the absence of the mitigation language from sub 1M and its presence in the immediately preceding subsection 1. But the state's argument, as I follow it, does establish a textual link suggesting that mitigation could apply. So we have 940.01, first-degree intentional homicide, sub 2 sub D, so mitigates the offense to second-degree intentional homicide. Coercion is one that it would mitigate to second, and that sub D refers to when the death was caused in the exercise of a privilege under 939.45 sub 1. So we jump down to that, and it says when the actor's conduct occurs under circumstances of coercion or necessity so as to be privileged under 939.46, which brings us back to the coercion statute where this affirmative defense lives. It is not restricted to sub 1. It references the entire statute, which would encompass 1M. So the link is there. It's a little convoluted, but I hate to use the word, it's a direct link. So why should we, what principles of law would direct this court to prefer your construction of the statute, which is a legally reasonable one, over the state's legally reasonable construction of the statutes in their entirety?
Sure. So I've got my link out here in front of me. And first of all, you're talking about under circumstances of coercion as to be privileged under 939.46. And 1M are not circumstances of coercion. There is no statutory element of coercion required to put forth the affirmative defense. Also, if you look at sub 2 and 939.45, when we're talking about the privilege of self-defense or defense of others or property, they use more expansive language. And I will note that when 939.45 was enacted back in 1955, it had all of these, all six subsections. The only thing that's been tinkered with since 1955 is sub 5 that deals with that parental disciplinary privilege. So the subsections at issue here have been the same since its enactment. But you'll notice that in sub 2, they use the language under any circumstances described in 939, 48, or 49, right? That's more expansive. It's pointing to the whole section as opposed to under circumstances of coercion. And I think part of what potentially you're getting at is that state has an interpretation, we have an interpretation, and is the way that 940.01 2D and 939.45 sub 1, is it now ambiguous as it applies to the new affirmative defense for trafficking victims 1M? And if it is ambiguous, we can look at the legislative history to see if that provides any guidance. And I think it does in this circumstance, in that the legislative history is silent about any mitigation, including when you're looking at the LRB analysis that went along with the bill here, which was 2007 Senate Bill 292. With regard to the affirmative defense, the LRB analysis stated, this bill also provides an affirmative defense for any offense committed by the victim of the trafficking offense as a direct result of the trafficking offense. It didn't say anything about mitigating, and it's, I think, a far stretch to say that the legislature specifically chose to mitigate first-degree intentional homicide, second-degree intentional homicide, but said nothing about it in the statutory language, like in the other defenses. But also, when interpreting it, no one said anything about mitigating first-degree to second-degree. I think that strongly supports the plain reading of 1M, which is that it applies to any offense in the same manner.
Thank you.
Do you give any significance to the use of the language has an affirmative defense? The fact that the legislature in sub 1M used that language, and that doesn't seem to appear, at least in other sections of 939-46, but I don't know if you give any significance to that language at all.
When you look at different statutes, sometimes they say you have a defense. Sometimes I think the more recent statutes tend to say you have an affirmative defense. When you look at self-defense, they talk about the conduct being privileged specifically. I don't know that it makes that much of a difference. I think this would still be asserted as a privilege, but if you look at 939-45 sub 6, that covers any other privilege in statute or at common law. So there's a catch-all provision for the privileges, and that was part of the original 939-45, which was enacted back in 1955. Okay. So,
any more questions?
And I think the state and I have agreed throughout this litigation about the process that this would follow. It tracks with the self-defense type of defense where we would have to present some evidence to the circuit court. That's a low bar. Everything would be viewed most favorably to the defense from the defendant's perspective, and if we meet that low bar, then ultimately this will be a jury instruction that is given to the jury. The state would have to disprove the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. If there are no more questions, I think I've hit my limit.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you. There's really kind of three points I want to make on rebuttal. And I guess I first want to start with to follow up on Justice Rogensack's question about this being broader than self-defense. And that is really the state's concern here, is that if you read direct result in a vacuum and just say, if you're a trafficking victim, you get to put this before a jury and argue direct result, then we can have a situation where a person has a privilege to kill someone else even when it's not reasonable and not necessary. Those are two of the key requirements of self-defense and also the other defenses of coercion, provocation.
Mr. Barber, is your concern relieved at all if we rely on the language in the Court of Appeals opinion in paragraph 15? Because what Attorney York wasn't saying that it's quite as broad as you just said. She's I'm forgetting which one of my colleagues taught you about it. I think it might have been, no, Justice Bradley did, one of the Bradleys.
Somebody raise our hand.
They're interchangeable.
not according to Patrick Marley. She's saying, no, it's not that broad. And she's saying, look, the paragraph 15 in the Court of Appeals brief limits it. It gives us a test. It gives us a way to limit it for circuit courts. She talked to Justice Hagedorn about how to limit it. So can you respond to that? Because I don't think it's quite as – the slope might be quite as slippery as it feels.
So I guess the state's biggest – aside from the mitigation aspect, the biggest criticism of the Court of Appeals opinion is all that stuff in paragraph 15 – I mean, in general, the state agrees with this phraseology. The problem is the Court of Appeals says this is just a list of factors. Here's a bunch of stuff for the jury to consider, which leaves open the possibility the jury could find something as a direct result, even if it is not immediately preceding, even if it is not reasonably foreseeable, and even if it is not, you know, even if it is motivated by other circumstances. So the state really sees these not as just as factors in some stew for the jury to consider, but as conditions prerequisite to this defense even applying.
Counsel, could you I know you're closing here, but just help same question I asked your opposing counsel, but what exactly would you like us to say? We hold that, fill in the blank.
Yeah, I mean, so I think our position on mitigation is pretty clear, so I puts that aside. In terms of what direct result means, I think the state wants the court to stress that it has to be some evidence of the three elements here, that there was a crime committed by a trafficking victim as a direct result of the trafficker's actions, and that direct result essentially means these things in paragraph 15 of the Court of Appeals opinion, that it's not a direct result if there is an intervening motivation or intervening agency. It's not a direct result if it doesn't flow immediately from the trafficking violation.
Did I hear you in that answer then embracing the three things that are set forth in paragraph 15, except embracing them with a negative? If it's not immediately, whatever the paragraph 15 first factor is, the temporal factor. If it's not relatively immediate, if it's not motivated primarily, etc., if it's not in significant part caused by. I mean, so it seems to me you're embracing those three things in your response to how you think the opinion should be written.
To the extent, I mean, that all that language came from the dictionary definitions and the case law definitions
right.
that the state had referenced about what direct result means. Our primary concern is, again, that this is just, here's some words for the jury to consider as opposed to a more structured, you must find these things in order for it to be a direct result.
What exact language are you asking for?
I'm asking for the court to define direct result to mean something that arises immediately from the trafficking violation, something that's a logical, foreseeable consequence and is not caused by events, circumstances, or considerations other than the violation, rather than just factors that are considered. The state wants those to be, these conditions must be met in order for it to be a direct result. And to follow up on one other point, finish here?
Yes.
We acknowledge there's not an express coercion element in the statute, but all of these subsections of coercion deal with circumstances where someone is exercising influence over another to do something to someone else. None of the provisions under coercion in the state's view contemplate the defendant doing something to the person who's allegedly doing the coercion, because that's traditional self-defense. That's provocation. And with that, I'll end.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for interesting briefs and oral arguments. Justice Dallet will be out to talk to Wisconsin Lutheran High School shortly, so you'll have a couple of minutes to stretch. Court will meet in conference at 1:30.